Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Mick Clifford, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Brendan.
Mick, it feels like another week between Nell and everything else, where we've been drawn back into the dark chapters. Think of Gatsby. We beat on against the tide, borne ceaselessly into the past. So, look, you've been writing about crime and the Gardaí for decades. You were the person that the whistleblower, Maurice McCabe, came to with his story. You have a special interest in miscarriages of justice, and your latest book is Who Killed Una Linsky? A True Story of Murder, Vigilante Justice and the Garda Heavy Gang. You've been stuck on this story for a long time. Was it Billy Flynn, the colourful private eye, who first embroiled you in this?
Billy Flynn, it's over 20 years ago now. I knew Billy, and he'd call out to Billy. He was very colourful, absolutely. He had an office in his home built around a snooker table. And like he did two photographs on the wall, one of the Pope and the other of the Magnificent Seven led by Yul Brynner. And to some extent, that whole environment summed up Billy. A serious man who was, you know, he was a bit offbeat. Anyway, Billy, I was in touch with Billy, various things. And he said, look, would you have a look at this story? And he brought me up to Porterstown Lane. That was 20 years ago. And he was trying to basically uncover what was a miscarriage of justice, and ultimately he did, and ultimately there was resolution in the Court of Criminal Appeal for one of the people who were targeted by it.
Okay, so tell me about Porterstown Lane first, where Una Linsky lived and where she went missing. So it's between Ratoath and Dunshaughlin, but there was this kind of close-knit community. I think you refer to them at times in the book as migrants. They were kind of settlers.
They were part of... No, it's something I wasn't aware of. Other people are. And it's actually not a controversy among historians. The Land Commission was an organisation whose records have not been publicly released, which is a bane for a number of historians. They had a big programme. It started with the Free State Government, and that was congested areas, they were called in the West. Effectively, farms that were unviable. They were too small, they were unviable. They'd been as a result of the land wars. And they started a programme, which was accelerated under Raymond de Valera in 1932, to get people to leave those, voluntarily obviously, to leave those farms, and they'd be given a small holding, principally in Meath and Kildare. So they were part of that migration, effectively, that came across under that programme. Now, at times, similar to what we see with migrants today, they weren't very welcome on the east of the country. There was a sign up, one person told me, in Athlone, go back, and all this sort of thing. There were a number of skirmishes. There was resentment, as referenced by Una Linsky's father, how they were never accepted there. Anyway, Porterstown Lane was one of these large holdings that the government bought, and it distributed among a number of families that came from the Belmullet area in 1940. And so the people who were involved in this were the sons and daughters of those who came over in the 40s. They all had small holdings in and around Porterstown Lane, which, as you say, is south of Ratoath. So it was a close-knit community. And one of them, for instance, Mary Conmee, told me that when she first went to school, she was amazed that everybody in school, their parents weren't from Mayo, because she thought that's just how things were, because they'd grown up in that community.
Okay, so in 1971 then, a very different Ireland, as we know, Una Linsky was 19 years old, and her family were quite prosperous at this stage. They'd done well, 11 children. She got the bus every day up to her job in Dublin.
Ironically, in the Land Commission, just happened to be, she had a job.
Okay, and so what do we know about the day she went missing then?
The day she went missing, she got the bus, Porterstown Lane as it was, the half that was connected to the Navan, it connects the Navan Road to the Ratoath Road. The half that was connected to the Navan Road was the area that was largely populated. Most people who went for a bus into Dublin or anywhere like that went to the bus on the Navan Road. Una didn't, for a very simple reason, that her cousin lived over on the Ratoath Road and she wanted to accompany her into work. She started a new job. So that's why she went across the unpopulated half of Porterstown Lane. She went to work as usual that day with her cousin Anne in the bus. She was coming home that evening. She got off the bus herself and Anne at 10 to 5 to 7, around that time. She said goodbye to Anne, who was living there, as they say, on that Ferry House Road area. She took off across the lane, and that was when effectively she disappeared. On that stretch of the unpopulated lane that should have taken her at the most about 15 minutes to walk home.
Okay, so small, close-knit community, as we say, rumours and speculation and everything started flying. Lots of people did report that they had seen a strange car on the lane that evening and that they had also heard screaming at a particular point.
Yes, there was a number of reports of screaming. Now, that was disputed somewhat by a subsequent investigation because two young kids who were out were imitating a dog's bark, but you know, I don't know how seriously that should be taken. There were definitely reports of screaming around that time, and the lane is kind of like a dog's leg, so it's not straight across, so you could hear far. Do you know what I mean? And it was flat, so yeah, you could hear a fair distance away. So there was a number of that. Also, there was a number of sightings of a car, a large car, a Zephyr or a Zodiac. Those were Ford models that predated the Executive and I think the Cortina. But they weren't that huge number of them about, which is pretty crucial to the story. Anyway, a number of people had seen this kind of car in the lane around that time. Not only that, there was a description from at least three different people of a driver who was middle-aged and balding and that kind of thing. So there was a strange car there with a description of a driver definitely seen by a number of the local people.
OK, and that will be important now. Hold that in your minds. That would sound like a definite line of inquiry. OK, so fear rampant in the community. People started locking their doors for the first time, girls not allowed out alone. And into this kind of then increasingly febrile atmosphere land the Garda Murder Squad. Who were they?
The Garda Murder Squad, they weren't officially the Murder Squad, they were known as the Murder Squad. Their official title was the Investigation Section of the Technical Unit in the Gardaí. This was effectively the sophisticated end of the Gardaí. Remember 1971, okay, the North blew up and that's a separate thing. Apart from that, this was a very peaceful society, an agrarian society. For instance, in 1971, there were 13 homicides in the country. Nearly nine of those were classified as murder, nearly all explainable by, you know, there was incidents of people having drink taken, there was a land issue. So that's the kind of society that was here at that time. So the Gardaí were not very sophisticated, largely because they didn't have to be, because that's what they dealt with. Very understandable. But in this technical unit, the investigation section was doing what you might say called non-technical element, you know, you had various forensic fingerprinting, etc. The investigation section was largely to do with obtaining confessions and getting statements. And as you said, this was known as the Murder Squad. They arrived in Porterstown Lane 48 hours after Una went missing to try and find out what exactly happened.
And they landed very quickly on a very definite line of inquiry and not maybe the obvious one.
Exactly. As we say, there had been a number of sightings of this strange car, strange man. Very quickly, possibly within a week or so, they focused on three local lads. Now, the time Una was walking home from the Rathaut end of Porterstown Lane, 10-15 minutes after that, three local lads, all of whom knew Una, were coming from the opposite direction, coming home from work, effectively. And they crossed the lane at that time. Not only that, they dropped off one of them, Martin Conmee. He was dropped off at home. He was effectively Una's next door neighbour. The other two continued in the car. And they subsequently told the Gardaí and everybody that night and the next morning, when they were passing an area known as the Three Acres, they saw a strange car, similar to the other witnesses, as a Zodiac or a Zephyr, and it was parked there and they just drove on. And that, in one way, you could say was another clue that this car was there. However, it would appear that the Gardaí viewed that as an invention and they reckoned that the three lads had something to do with Una's disappearance.
OK. And now, look, we could get bogged down here in a lot of detail of the investigation and inconsistencies and everything, but there are shocking aspects of this to come. So the lads are brought in for what you might call robust questioning then for 48 hours.
44, with another fella, a friend of theirs, Christo Innes. Christo was another, he lived on the lane with his family. And it would appear in the Garda theory, as it was, these three lads encountered Una. Something happened. Una got in the car. Something happened that rendered her unconscious or probably dead. Now, this is a theory the Garda had. But then they had a problem about what happened to the body if that was the case. And it appears that early on, and this is with absolutely no evidence, early on they got it into their heads that Christo Ennis might have had something to do with it. They might have left the body in his house, which was totally, there was absolutely zero basis for thinking. So Christo was brought in too, but he was let go fairly early. The other three were held for 48 hours. They have always maintained they were assaulted, beaten, intimidated, in custody, and two of them made statements, disjointed statements that didn't have a proper narrative, that they had met Una. Now, apart from their claims of being assaulted, they went to doctors afterwards, and a number of physical injuries were recorded by the doctors within a day or two of them coming out of that custody. But thereafter, things went really crazy, because at that point, particularly those interviews, the Linsky family came to believe, and the Gardaí were based at their Linsky home for a lot of the investigation, they came to believe that these three lads, their neighbours, who'd grown up with Una, were responsible for her disappearance.
And the thing is, as you point out, and it is kind of important, that even the confessions that were potentially beaten out of these guys didn't add up to a consistent story. Then there were statements taken from various other people. I mean, the whole thing sounds farcically. There was one 13-year-old gave four different statements, like, and not kind of each one in advance on the other, each of them wildly different. Like, and it seemed as if there was a story that needed to be backed up. The guards had a story and they needed to put it together in some way.
They needed to get stuff to fit their theory. As you said, there's a 13-year-old, four statements. There's a school teacher who'd walked the length of the lane that evening, three different statements. For example, in the first, she didn't see a car coming back the lane the way the Gardaí thought the boys would be after encountering Una. In the second, she thought she may have saw it either that day or the previous day, which is unusual because she walked a lot, and there was fellas with long hair. And in the third, her statement actually identified Dick Donnelly's car. And the crucial thing, and this was brought up subsequently by a judge in the Court of Criminal Appeal, the crucial thing is the trajectory of all these statements, in none of them was there a reason given as to why this had not been revealed in the previous statement, which is the first thing you'd ask. So you had that sort of situation, as well as what had gone on in the Garda station. Now, the other crucial thing about the Garda station is, one would have thought, if these fellas were confessing, you're talking about fellas who, young fellas, carefree, 20 years of age, if they were confessing, where is Una's body? They came away, there was no hint of that, nothing. None of them had a clue where it was. And one would have thought that if they were confessing or anything, that's the obvious question. Yeah. So the whole thing was very disjointed.
Okay, so even then, so the tensions are rising in the community, as you say. Even when the body was found, it didn't seem to change the trajectory of the investigation. So you have these three lads, as you say, Linsky family become convinced they are the suspects. They obviously... The guards are making it look as if they are as well. And then this really shocking kind of vigilante lynch mob almost lights on one of the three, Marty Kerrigan, dragged out of a police car. What happened to him?
Marty was the youngest of the three. He also lived off the lane. They lived in an area called The Bush, just up the road. He was also the only male young fella in his family. The other two, Martin Conmee and Dick Donnelly, both had a number of brothers. And there had been various skirmishes once this started between the Linsky faction and the others. So Marty was vulnerable to some extent. One way or the other, they got it into their head that Marty was particularly guilty in whatever form. It ended up, he was getting a lift to a dance with a Garda. There was a car crash outside Rathaut. The Garda went in to sort it out. The Linskys and their allies showed up, and there was a street battle effectively between the two. Marty got dragged into the car with two of the Linskys and their first cousin. He was brought up to the Dublin Mountains to a spot that was more or less where Una's body had been found 10 days previously. And now ultimately they were convicted of manslaughter. They claimed they didn't mean to kill him, but his body was found there within hours of those fellas arriving back in Porterstown Lane.
So if we just stop for a minute there, we now have a second young person dead and killed by his neighbours in all of this. I mean, it's horrific stuff. So we come to the court cases, and the killing of Marty Kerrigan was the first case to come to court.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, it was a fairly, one would have thought, open and shut case. One of the defendants gave evidence. Two others were supposed to, they didn't. It was perfectly obvious they took him away. Nobody was disputing any of the facts. The only facts that were in dispute was whether or not they had deliberately killed him or whether they had left him up in the mountain and somehow he had died unintentionally. There was one crucial piece of medical evidence, and that was that there had been an attempt, it would appear, to disembowel him, and that wound was inflicted after his death, and that nobody disputed that medical evidence from the pathologist at the time. Despite that, they had claimed that they had intended to kill him. Ultimately, the jury went with them and they found him guilty of manslaughter, and they were sentenced to 3 years in prison each.
So then the trial for the killing of Una Linsky, of the two remaining suspects. Now, it sounds completely farcical. Like, so a lot of the witnesses refused to stand by the earlier multiple statements they'd made or their latest statements. The allegations of Garda brutality weren't heard by the jury.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, a number of them changed their statements. And usually, you know, if somebody changes a statement like that, there's one of two reasons. Either they're afraid of somebody, as in perhaps the defendants, or else they gave the statement originally in conditions that that were totally inappropriate and wrong.
And you feel socially perjury and swearing on a Bible might have made people think a bit more back then.
Well, in general terms, Brendan, I mean, you know, it was a pretty Catholic country. You can call it pious, how spiritual it was or whatever. But in people took seriously the idea of swearing on the Bible. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody believes that everybody told the truth who swore in the Bible. But people assumed that everybody would think twice before they would put their soul in peril. We're talking back in Catholic Ireland at this time. And within that context, the number of Gardaí who gave evidence that nothing happened in that station, they didn't witness anything inappropriate, nobody was assaulted, all of that. You know, if they were telling the truth, well and good. If they weren't, you were talking about organised perjury happening at the time. So that was an element of things in the case. The trial within the trial, a voir dire, as it's called, to determine whether what happened in the Garda station when they'd been brought in should be heard. It ultimately concluded that some of the admissions should be. There was very little heard about the allegations of brutality. And as you said, I couldn't see a trial like that happening today. But again, the ultimate outcome was manslaughter. And
as we've heard earlier, was a trumped up story.
Yeah.
Created by the guards.
A trumped up story.
Got passed the court.
Absolutely. Then. Not only that, and you could say that if the jury believed that these three guys had, or two of them, as was claimed at some stage, had encountered Una and had assaulted her in some capacity and had buried her body and walked away, if they genuinely believed that to be the case, one would ask, well, why didn't they find him guilty of murder? If they genuinely, yeah, on the basis of the evidence, believed that the evidence wasn't there to convict these guys, then you have the appalling vista in their minds that the trial that had preceded this a few months previously, did those fellas kill an innocent man? And, you know, you could suggest, as I have in the book, that was that in the jury's minds? Was what happened outside the courtroom, outside the evidence, in their minds when they came to that conclusion? Ultimately, they came to that conclusion. The two guys got 3 years, the exact same sentence as the three who had killed Marty Kerrigan. And following that, Dick Donnelly, on appeal, on the basis he had made no admissions whatsoever, he got off. Martin Kerrigan served 3 years in Mountjoy. Martin Conmee.
Okay, and we'll come back to Martin Conmee in a second. Maybe we should just stop a minute now to explain about the Heavy Gang. So this case is cited as one example of the Heavy Gang, and the Heavy Gang would go on to be involved in other high-profile miscarriages of justice as well. Indeed, the Kerry babies that we talked a lot about this week.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, this was 1971. And as we say, we talk about Heavy Gang, it has to be put in context. As I said, it was a peaceful country. And the Gardaí, and to this day, unlike in other jurisdictions, they're also in charge of the security of the state. So the Gardaí effectively policing on two fronts. One, this agrarian, relatively peaceful society. And on the other, taking on the Provisional IRA, highly organised group, very careful at forensics, ensuring any witnesses would not give evidence and all that. So whether somebody decided, whether it evolved, whatever, throughout the 70s and into the 80s, the Heavy Gang, a group loosely based around the murder squad, got a notorious reputation for beating up suspects in custody. Initially, this had to do with suspects involved in the political issues in the north, and subsequently it moved into others. It was nearly as if, once they realised they had impunity to do this thing, it didn't matter whether the things they were investigating had to do with the security of the state or whether they were what you might call ordinary crimes. The most famous one in terms of the political situation was the Salins mail train robbery, which three men were convicted of. Ultimately, Nicky Kelly became a celebrated case, and they were freed, they were pardoned, they ultimately got compensation. No investigation has ever taken place into what happened there in a policing and judicial failure. The other major one, there's a few others, and I've mentioned them in the book, but the other major one, as you said, the Kerry babies. Remember in that case, a family who could not have murdered a baby that was found in Carsevine confessed to driving out Slayhead and throwing a body into the sea such that the currents would bring it across the bay to Carsevine. It never happened. Yet this family admitted it after being interrogated in custody. Of course, we now know that the tribunal report has been repudiated 35, 40 years later. But again, there never was any proper investigation into what happened there.
Yeah, there's an interesting sidebar to this, probably not a conversation for today, but in a way, without excusing any of the heavy gang tactics, this is another way in which the Troubles corrupted this state, isn't it? And like,
absolutely.
I'm sure old guards have told you that guards who were up at the border, guards who were involved in this, they were never the same.
Absolutely.
Afterwards.
Yeah, and as one guard has said to me, and this was said elsewhere, in terms of the political violence, when they got someone, they reckoned if they weren't guilty of this, they were guilty of somebody else. Now, that's unacceptable in a democratic state. But you also have to put in the context of a large swathe of the population were willing to tolerate that because they saw also that the likes of the provost wanted to overthrow the state. And if this thing was going on, people turned a blind eye. They never should have. But that's the corrosive effect that kind of violence will have on a society.
Now, Martin Comley did his time and he got out and I think initially tried to just get on with his life, didn't he?
He did, his time.
But ultimately, he couldn't live with it. He wanted to clear his
Martin
name.
Got out, he got married, he had a son. And then in 1989, he had an epiphany. Effectively, he was watching TV and Gerry Conlon coming out of the Old Bailey, the famous, that iconic shot of him saying, "I'm an innocent man." And Martin broke down when he saw that. And he said he'd go about trying to clear his name. He went to John Bruton, actually, and John Bruton was in opposition at the time, his local TD, and he put in a question. He was told that can't be dealt with because it already was. Now, subsequent to that, the law changed. You had an act in 1993 that allowed for new evidence to be introduced. Meanwhile, the Kerrigan sisters, who lived up the road, they were all still friendly, they'd heard about Billy Flynn. They went to Billy. He reinvestigated it. Between the whole thing, a solicitor was able to put together a case that showed crucial evidence had not been presented at the first trial where Martin had been convicted. And that crucial evidence was earlier statements that had been given by two fellas who also claimed they were beaten up by the Gardaí were not shown, which could have had a totally different complex on the thing. He ultimately was overturned. And the crucial thing there, a conviction getting overturned is one thing. A miscarriage of justice, that's a higher step again. And Martin ultimately got a certificate of miscarriage of justice and compensation from the state for how he'd been treated.
Okay. So look, there's all that chaos around the investigation and miscarriages of justice and everything else. But actually, again, step back and what we have is two terrible tragedies here. And we have two families here who have actually still not got justice. The Linskys still don't have justice. Where is that at now?
Absolutely. And that is, as you say, Una Linsky was murdered. I think there can be very little doubt about that. Nobody has ever been held culpable. So there's
is
a cold case.
There is
okay. A cold case review. Now, that was opened after the Kerrigans went to the Garda Commissioner. And very understandably, and I think this is important, they want some acknowledgement that Marty, who was killed violently at 19 years of age, was a murder suspect at the time by the Gardaí, but that was totally wrong and unfair, and the man should have his record wiped clean in that regard. There's no process they can go through because he hadn't been charged with anything. So they went to the Garda Commissioner. He indicated he'd do something, but then events overtook because a cold case review was started. That's looking into both killings now. Now, I still can't understand why that stops the commissioner or the state making some gesture to the Kerrigans as to why their son or their brother as it was a murder suspect at the time he died.
So Marty Kerrigan's name has not been cleared.
Effectively, yeah. As I say, no, he wasn't charged or convicted, but the reason he was killed was because the Gardaí suspected him of murder.
Because he was framed.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So look, back to the title of the book and to the tragedy that started all this, poor young Una Linsky. Who did kill Una Linsky, or what do you think now, or what are the theories?
Well, look, the obvious suspect, and a number of people saw him, there was a number of descriptions, was this middle-aged man in the car, one, possibly two men. Now, the big problem is, as I say, within a week, the Gardaí decided that had nothing to do with their investigation. If you don't have some lead within a week, the trail goes cold. That was completely ignored. It would not have been a mammoth task, for instance, to trace all those type of cars in the country. And there would have been other ways. It would have been dogged, boring, dirty, slow police work. And they'd no record of that at that time. So I came across, in the course of investigating this book, one person who contacted me who reckoned that a relative of theirs, they believed and soon after, had been responsible. This relative and another individual, both of whom were deceased now, used to go to race meetings. By the way, Fairy House Racecourse was like right around the corner from Porterstown Lane. That was never pursued. I don't know whether anyone contacted the guards at the time. But the Cold Case Review is going to try and find out who may have killed Una.
It's too late.
It's a long shot.
Yeah, yeah. That is a shame and very tough for the Linskys. And this is very, very tough for the Kerrigan family as well. You would hope they'd get some kind of satisfaction out of all this. Okay, the book is called Who Killed Una Linsky? And you can tell reading it, Mick, it was a passion project for you, and it's written with great gusto and everything. And it is another great insight into that Ireland. Who Killed Una Linsky, published by Penguin. Mick Clifford, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
Email brendan@rte.ie.